Hi, I'm Simon Smart from CPX, and you're listening to the Richard Johnson Lecture Series. In this episode, you'll hear Scott Stephens' 2021 lecture titled Out of Sight, Attentiveness in a Dismissive Age. We commonly hear that the times in which we live are unprecedented. Well, not entirely without justification when we consider the proliferation of technologies that flood our waking hours. Yet beneath the busy surface of our media-saturated age, there lurks a temptation that is in no way unprecedented. That's the old temptation to live superficially, which is to say, inattentively. Like Shakespeare's King Lear, we increasingly crave affection, fear irrelevance, are unsure who to trust, and so banish those who might wound us out of our sight. The eyes are a moral organ. The contemptuous gaze can wither. The attentive glance gives life. At a time when so many distractions can cloud our vision, Scott Stephens urges us, in the tender words of the loyal Kent in King Lear, to see better.
Thank you for that really kind introduction. It's an unexpected, and I'm afraid to say, a rather undeserving honor to be asked to deliver the Richard Johnson Lecture this year. Ever since the beginning of my time at the ABC, when the Religion and Ethics website was still in its infancy, I've been most grateful for the support of the Center for Public Christianity. I really would love to be there with you all. It seems to me there is simply no substitute for presence. Justine mentioned before some of my early work on the really strange Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek. But one thing that I learned early on, a lesson I learned from Žižek when I first started working on him, is this. You cannot love your neighbor unless you can smell your neighbor. It's a strange thing to say, I'll admit, but it does touch on, I think, a vital insight that there is something indispensable about proximity, about closeness in what we might call moral encounter. Those moments when the moral reality of another person, their depth of feeling, the intensity of their convictions, the particular ways they express their love or their fear, their hurt or their grief, the way that they show the preciousness of their frail and flawed humanity. That's what I mean by the moral reality of another person. All the things that make them distinctly, concretely, peculiarly human. Moral encounter are those moments when the moral reality of another person impresses itself upon us, demanding of us, I think, a posture of responsiveness, tenderness even, and not just self-assertion. These moments of moral encounter, these are moments that require, I think, gentleness and tact. They demand a certain hesitation as if we were treading on holy ground. But these are moments that also require courage. They're moments that require that we know when to speak and when to be silent, maybe at a time when a little bit too much has been said, something too true has been spoken, and that truth needs to linger undisturbed in the air between us. These moments of moral encounter are moments when there can be no other agenda, no ulterior goal than to pay the closest possible attention to the person that's there in front of us. Strangely enough, I think, these moments of moral encounter can be found in the throes of or on the very brink of intense interpersonal conflict or disagreement. And yet moral encounters often find their resolution not through one side winning and the other side losing, but precisely by neither side being entirely victorious over the other. Instead, rather than victory or defeat, which usually means the breakdown of the relationship between the two people, there's something closer to mutual transformation that takes place between the two people. It's almost as if both people in this moment of moral encounter have come to see each other and themselves in an entirely different light. If I can just take a quick philosophical sidestep for a moment, this, I think, is what the great philosopher John Stuart Mill from the 19th century meant when he described a virtuous, healthy marriage as one in which each party enjoys the luxury of looking up to one another. Or it's when the German philosopher from around the same time, Georg Hegel, described a good marriage as what happens when each comes to see themselves through the other person's eyes. Now, both John Stuart Mill and Hegel use the example of marriage there, but for Aristotle or for Montaigne, these are descriptions, mutual looking up to one another, seeing each other through one another's eyes, seeing themselves through one another's eyes. These are descriptions that both Aristotle and Montaigne would use for friendship. I think maybe it says something about the times that we live that we no longer describe friendship in those kind of rich ways, ways that enable, that allow for the possibility of moral encounter. The only truly intimate relationship that we know how to talk in terms of is marriage. But that's a discussion for another day. It's in these moments of moral encounter, in other words, that I think we discover an answer to the question that was put to Jesus, who is my neighbor? The answer, of course, is the person, the moral reality of the person that presents themselves directly in front of you, demanding responsiveness, attention. Now, I realize that, especially this early in the lecture, I realize that my description of what I'm calling moral encounter might seem incredibly abstract, maybe even a little bit unrealistic. Surely relationships between human beings don't actually look like that. And it can be difficult, I think, to find real-world examples to flesh out what it is I mean, not least because moments of moral encounter are almost always particular to the people involved. These moments entail a degree of intimacy that's hard to convey or to project to those outside of that particular moment of moral encounter. But there are, thankfully, some examples, some quite moving passages or portions of films or television or novels that we can draw on in order to draw out this sense of what we mean by moral encounter, what moral encounter looks like. I can think, for example, of the tenderness with which Monseigneur Myriel responds to the criminal Jean Valjean after Valjean steals a number of consecrated silver chalices and plates from the bishop's home in Victor Hugo's novel Les Misérables. The musical doesn't actually get this too badly either. Myriel doesn't just forgive Valjean after he was arrested by the gendarmes, nor does Myriel merely cover for Valjean, giving him an alibi so that he can escape or get out of the police's custody. Instead, Myriel both permits Valjean to keep the silver that he stole, telling the police that they were gifts, and even more than that, the bishop gives Valjean some silver candlesticks as well from his mantelpiece, all items that were consecrated for uses on the altar, for the sacrament, for the Eucharist. By giving these gifts, by turning theft into gift, isn't Monseigneur Myriel revealing the true purpose of consecration to God's service? That these things aren't simply to be holed away and kept secret, kept safe, but rather they're to be used for the redemption of the life of another human being. When Monseigneur Myriel addresses Valjean as my brother, my friend, by Myriel transforming what was a theft into a gift, he redeems Valjean's life. I should also say that Victor Hugo's description of every moment on Valjean's face, his wide-eyed terror, his faltering movement, his surprise and trembling, nearly fainting, right through to weeping, the description, I think, of the moral reality of Valjean is remarkable. And this is the final address that Myriel addresses Valjean with. Forget not that you have promised to me to use this silver to become an honest man. Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil, but to good. It is your soul that I am buying for you. I withdraw it from the dark thoughts and from the spirit of perdition, and I give it to God. This is a moment of mutual transformation, of moral encounter. Take the different example of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Elizabeth Bennet has already made up her mind that the famous Mr. Darcy, my wife still, I'm convinced, has a crush on him, that Mr. Darcy is cruel, aloof, contemptuous, and untrustworthy. And yet Elizabeth Bennet receives a letter from Mr. Darcy out of the blue, in which he utterly overturns her certain knowledge of his character, his motives, his conduct. After reading this letter, where he gives an account of himself, of his soul, she declares that she has been blind, partial, prejudiced, absurd. She says, moreover, that until that moment, I never knew myself. A moment of moral encounter mediated by a letter, but that gives rise to a richer encounter between these two people. Take another example from E.M. Forster's extraordinary novel, Howard's End. The young and brilliant Margaret Schlegel marries the older, wealthier, and somewhat morally obtuse industrialist Henry Wilcox. Margaret is under no illusions as to Henry's character or his moral deficiencies. Nevertheless, she believes that for him to become a good man, what's required isn't what she calls a good talking to. Instead, she says, by quiet indications, the bridge between them can be built that can span their lives with beauty. Beautiful description. Margaret Schlegel is over and over and over again frustrated by Henry's moral blindness, his lack of self-knowledge. And yet, the novel says about her surface, her appearance, could always respond to his surface appearance without contempt, although all her deeper being might be yearning to help him. She nevertheless, over the course of their marriage, abandoned any plan of action. Love is best, she said to herself. And the more she let herself love him, the greater their chance would be that he would set his soul in order. But then there arrives a point towards the end of the novel, some years later, after some years of marriage, when Henry's blindness, his egotism, his self-possession tips over into cruelty as he condemns Margaret's sister, Helen, for an indiscretion of which he, as a young man, was also guilty, sex out of marriage. He refuses to give Margaret's sister, Helen, and her illegitimate child refuge in their country home. He refuses to give them refuge because doing so might tarnish the Wilcoxes' otherwise good name. The novel says the precipice was at their feet now. They're standing, in other words, at the brink of a moral encounter. Margaret urges him to rise to the moment, to recognize that by condemning Helen, he is also condemning himself. He refuses with a self-satisfied, imperious disdain. Margaret explodes. It's a quote from the novel. Not any more of this. Stupid, hypocritical, cruel, contemptible man. I've spoilt you long enough. All your life you've been spoilt. No one has ever told you what you are. Muddled, criminally muddled. Men like you use repentance as a blind, and so you don't repent. Only say these words to yourself. What Helen has done, I have done. Margaret is angry, yes. But through every word she's spoken, she bears the love that she's borne for Henry throughout the course of their marriage. She brings with it her patience, her pleading, her desire for Henry simply to see the connection between what it is he has done and what it is that he has condemned. She's inviting him to a moment of deep reflection, of self-knowledge. But these are words, what Helen has done, I have done. These are words that Henry is unable to say, for if he did so, his sense of himself would begin to unravel. Henry refuses the moment of transformation that's being held out to him. The marriage carries on, but it limps along with both parties diminished. I've used a number of literary examples. You're probably sick of them now. Let's go a bit lowbrow, shall we? In the fifth, and remember, we're describing moments, examples of moral encounter, where something takes place between two individuals, where there's a recognition of their shared humanity, of the peculiarity of what is demanded in this particular situation. There's no other agenda than what is demanded by these two people addressing one another, being morally present to one another. We're describing these moments of moral encounter in which mutual transformation takes place, or in the example of Howard's End, moral transformation doesn't quite take place. So, in the final ninth season of the US sitcom The Office, the marriage between salesman Jim and receptionist Pam, the relationship that's kept us enthralled for the previous 9 years, that marriage is breaking down before our eyes. A work opportunity in Philadelphia is taking Jim away from his family in Scranton for days at a time. He and Pam, by not telling the truth to one another, have grown incommunicative. They've grown emotionally distant from one another. Every attempt that they make at articulating their own pain ends up inflicting a further injury on the other person. Words seem hopelessly inadequate. They both take refuge in a kind of cold silence. One day, Jim prepares to leave work at the office in Scranton for another few days away from his family in Philadelphia. He and Pam say their perfunctory, hollow goodbyes. In the office, he walks downstairs to a waiting taxi. Pam realizes he's forgotten his umbrella and runs down after him. She catches up to him outside as he's getting into a taxi. She gives him the umbrella. For just a moment, they face one another. They stand silently before one another. Jim unexpectedly steps forward and hugs her, awkwardly at first, because Pam doesn't reciprocate. She doesn't respond. Her arms are out, maybe due to surprise, maybe due to injury, the emotional hurt that's been inflicted, maybe because of simple uncertainty. The scene of Jim embracing Pam and Pam with her arms out is interrupted by a flashback to Jim and Pam's wedding, during which one of Jim's brothers reads from 1 Corinthians 13. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Pam, wordlessly, returns the embrace. All moments, it seems to me, of moral encounter. The persistent question for me, as someone who works in the media, is whether screens can, in fact, mediate or provide the right conditions for such moments of moral encounter. That's, after all, the flip side of Slavoj Žižek's dictum, you can only love your neighbor if you can smell your neighbor. What if you can't smell your neighbor? Can you still really love your neighbor? Can screens mediate moments of moral encounter, of exposure of the moral reality of the life of one person to another? I've come seriously to doubt it. For screens in interpersonal communication function something like a kind of moral prophylactic. They let you get close to another person, but not too close, and certainly not close enough to leave open the risks of unintended consequences. Screens, by their very nature, are mechanisms of convenience and control. They give us the appearance of connection, but only ever under conditions of our choosing. You can turn it off. You can move away. You can be close, but not too close. And screens most often screen out those qualities of human communication on which moral encounter most powerfully depends. Think about, for instance, the barely perceptible wince at words that were badly said and have been found unintentionally harmful. You can't pick that up across the screen. Consider the flash of recognition that lights up somebody's eyes when there's a moment that something has been understood and maybe shared ground between two people has been discovered. Think about the tender glance that's exchanged when one person displays a kind of forbearance or patience at another person's folly or stupidity or ignorance. Or think about the tone of desperation, like when Margaret Schlegel says, "Can't you see the connection?" The tone of desperation that often softens the rebuke of another person's moral incomprehension. All of these things take skill, take practice to discern. And if we're not careful, our over-reliance on screens to connect ourselves with one another will render us so unpracticed in the art of moral encounter that we become eventually incapable of it. In case you're wondering, I have been focusing here on the visual medium because I hope that audio may just be different. I think there are possibilities of intimacy that arise through audio, even through things like radio and podcast, done well over time. I think there are occasions for intimacy that may well make audio a more morally conducive medium, at least under very particular conditions. There is then a kind of cruel irony, I think, in the fact that we've had to resort to the mediation of screens to speak to one another. You've probably picked up by now that I've long been concerned that the omnipresence of screens in our lives, these little windows onto the world, these windows into the lives of one another, has not made us see one another better. I worry that the unprecedented proliferation and publication and dissemination of words, we are swimming in text, we are swimming in words, has not made us better readers. I've taken to describing our current condition as one of moral illiteracy. We can read the words okay, but we're not sensitive to them. We only find ourselves moved by the most excessive or silly, the most alarmist or banal, by those messages that are at once short, shallow, and loud. And yet even then, when we're interested by these words, these interests or our outrage only flashes and is very, very soon to fade. So I think screens have not made us see one another better. I think the proliferation of words has not made us better readers. I also worry constantly that the incessant and instant transmission of what was called in the 19th century thoughts through the air has not really closed the moral distance between us. It's not really brought us closer together. Remember that the non-print media used to be called the airwaves. And right back in the middle of the 19th century, the highest aspiration for these media, from the laying of the transatlantic cable to the invention of the telephone, from the first mass-produced, mass-market newspapers right through to television, cable, the internet, social media, the great dream for all of these new media is that they would turn people's hearts towards their neighbors in common understanding and sympathy. We now live in times that have often seemed to me to represent the fulfillment of the prophecy given by the elderly monk Zosima in Dostoevsky's novel, The Brother Karamazov, in the middle of the 19th century. The aged monk rejects the prophecy, the 19th century confidence, quote, that the world will become more united, that it will form itself into a brotherly communion by shortening the distance and by transmitting thoughts through the air. These fraternal inclinations, this turning of people towards one another, Zosima is convinced, will soon be overwhelmed by that same technology's multiplication of senseless and stupid desires, habits, absurd inventions, desires which demand speedy satisfaction lest they turn into resentment, inventions which endlessly pander to our appetite for the trivial and the obscene, habits which disconnect us from one another, in fact, isolating us in the idiocy of our envy and mutual suspicion. The air, Zosima says, that is meant to bear our common aspirations to one another will in this way grow thick with distrust, choking out thoughts of communality and ultimately widening the gap between us. It's hard to imagine, I think, a more prescient, a more accurate description of the afflictions of our social media-saturated age. It's little wonder in our time that so many of us have turned inwardly upon ourselves, fearful about reaching out an open hand to others, instead using our time online to posture for our tribes of the already convinced, or else spend our time competing for attention, for recognition within Mark Zuckerberg's debauched empire of likes. These different media, these media that fill our airwaves, that are meant to connect us, have filled our lives with substitutes for moral encounter, all the while convincing us that they are the real thing. But as everybody knows over the last 2 years who has tried to gather and worship, who have tried to socialize, to truly connect over these extended periods of lockdown, we all know by now that there is no substitute for presence, for proximity, that these forms of media are not just not the real thing, they're parodies of real connection, real moral encounter. I want to linger for a moment with this idea of the air that's between us, this air that has grown thick with distrust and hostility and fear, the air in which we've turned inwardly upon ourselves, fearful about reaching out to others. I've come to think of so much of what's happened in our common life over the last 2 years, the crises that have hit like hammer blows, one after the other, after the other, from the bushfires at the end of 2019 to the pandemic of 2020 and 21, from the suffocation of George Floyd in May 2020, right through to the escalating climate crisis that is so much on our minds, on our hearts at the moment. Each one of these crises, what we might call in its own way, a crisis of breathing, a crisis of the air. Haven't the last 2 years left us acutely aware of the air around us, but also suspicious of our fellow breathers? We've become wary of the capacity of other people to infect us, their ability to deprive us of the ability to breathe. You could say that the events of the last 2 years have impressed upon us a recognition of the communality of the air, that the air isn't just breathed, but it's shared, that it's our dwelling, our habitat, our common home, that the air is the medium of our natural lives, yes, but it's also the vital element that sustains our lives and that carries our words from one person to another. I think we've also then been reminded over the last 2 years for just this reason, because we know that the air is common, that it's shared, that it's our common home. We've also seen the many ways in which air can be denied or withheld as a form of punishment in the example, the horrific example of George Floyd, for instance, or that air can become so corrupted with the multiplication, the pollution of social vices like vanity, egotism, callousness, contemptuousness, inattentiveness, thoughtlessness, deceitfulness, distrustfulness, vengefulness, cruelty, injustice, and mutual intimidation, that the air becomes, in effect, unbreathable for others. It's so often the experience of so many people I know who try to come out into something like public debate, who try to participate, who try to make their voices known, their experience being greeted with this wall of egotism and callousness, contemptuousness, vanity, cruelty, that they find themselves experiencing a form of moral suffocation, the inability really to breathe, the inability really to speak. But think about also, in far more realistic, far more graphic terms, this question. What are the moral conditions? What is the moral atmosphere in which George Floyd could plead with his captors, telling him, "I can't breathe," not less than 27 times while he lay prone beneath a police officer's knee pressing down on the back of his neck, and yet for his pleas to be met with a kind of blithe contempt, If you can speak, you can breathe. What are the moral conditions? What is the moral atmosphere that could account for the humanity of this response to the cries, the pleas for air on the part of another human being in fear of their life? We could call this kind of moral incomprehension, this moral obtuseness to the humanity of another person. We could call this an extreme form of contempt, but I think it's better to call it what it is, a form of soul blindness, of chronic, extreme inattentiveness to the reality of another human being. In all of these ways, I think, particularly over the last 2 years, we've been forcefully reminded that the air around us is not just a given. If it's to remain morally habitable for human beings, the air between us must be cultivated. It must be tended to. I know that sounds strange. I know that sounds weird. But I think this is what the legal philosopher Jeremy Waldron is getting at when he describes hate speech as poisoning the air around us, creating something like an environmental threat to social peace. Hate speech is a pollutant. It causes some people among us not to be able to breathe, to find a voice, to have themselves heard. This, I think, is what the moral philosopher Cécile Bock, in her wonderful book on lying, this is what she describes when she says, whatever matters to human beings, trust is the atmosphere in which it thrives. Trust cultivates the air. It makes the air breathable for one another. It facilitates mutual moral encounter. By contrast, distrust, lack of truthfulness, mendacity, lying, the breaking of trust, humiliation, these are all things that make the air unbreathable, that cause people not to be able to catch their breath, that render people inarticulate, unable to speak, unable to be heard.
We'll be back to the lecture after a short break.
Today, there are over 40 million people trapped in slavery. That's more than ever before in human history. We are International Justice Mission, and we believe we can end slavery in our lifetime. Together with our local partners, RJM rescues and restores victims, brings criminals to justice, and strengthens justice systems. To find out more, visit rjm.org.au. International Justice Mission. Until all are free.
And now, back to the lecture.
What is it that the great 19th century philosopher-poet Walt Whitman is declaring when he says in the middle of the 19th century, democracy most of all affiliates with the open air? I mean, surely, in saying that, he's commending the importance of communion, of gathering in the natural world for the ongoing renewal of a democratic culture. If everyone's holed up in pokey, dirty, dusty cities in confined, dark, cramped rooms, it stifles joy, vivacity, mutual conversation. Okay, he's saying that, absolutely. But throughout his life, Whitman retained an undiluted enthusiasm for the energies of city life. He loved cities, New York in particular. So he writes, for instance, quote, it is not nature alone that is great in her fields of freedom and open air, but in the artificial, in the work of man too, is equally great. In this profusion of teeming humanity, in these ingenuities, streets, goods, houses, ships, in these hurrying, feverish, electric crowds of men. He's describing here the streets of New York City in the 19th century. So he's saying it's not just in nature that there's a kind of energy of freedom and open air, but also within cities. So Whitman's concern isn't just with the spaces that human beings inhabit, the rural versus the urban, the natural versus the artificial. But what Whitman's primary concern isn't with the spaces human beings inhabit, but with the spaces between human beings, and the degree to which the spaces between human beings are conducive to human connection, to moral encounter. And so for Whitman, it's the task of showing the connections that exist between human beings. It's this task of linking people together, of showing their true spiritual connection that he takes as the central occupation of the poet in a democracy that is still striving, hoping to become a moral reality. That's why Whitman says in Leaves of Grass that the poet is a joiner. He sees how people join. And after he writes that, this is what he writes. He, probably speaking of himself, he was rather vain. He says indifferently and alike, "How are you, friend?" to the president at his levee. And he says, "Good day, my brother," to Cudge that hoes in the sugar field. And both understand him and know that his speech is right. The scene that Whitman pictures here is one that I find really striking, not because the poet does anything remarkable. The words that he speaks aren't overly profound. Instead, by addressing both president and slave, that surely is the implication of Cudge hoeing in the sugar field, by addressing both president and slave with warm familiarity, the poet takes upon himself the role of a representative figure, someone who stands, quoting Whitman, "for what there is in each single individual, something so transcendent, something so incapable of gradations that it places all beings on a common level, utterly regardless of the distinctions of intellect, virtue, station, of any height or lowliness, whatever." He's saying that thing, that precious thing that exists in all human beings, which makes them ultimately equals. Which is to say, for Whitman, the poet acts as a parable of our common humanity. But what I find really remarkable in this moment in Whitman's poem is the way that the poet expresses this commonness. Whitman's poet doesn't make an argument for the fundamental equality of persons. The poet doesn't rage or denounce the stubborn persistence of gross inequality, to say nothing of slavery, in a society founded on egalitarian principles. The poet might have done so. Many people in Whitman's day did precisely that, forcefully. But here, at this moment, in this scene, on this occasion, in this poem, the poet simply greets his fellows with words that are available to anyone to say. "How are you, friend? Good day, my brother." But words which, when spoken, permit what Whitman calls the common level of these two, the president and the slave. It permits their true connection to be seen. We could say that in speaking these words, "Good day, my friend. How are you, my brother?" the poet establishes the conditions of moral community between present and between slave. By addressing both in the same way, with the same dignity, with the same warm familiarity, the poet permits both to be seen as entirely worthy of the poet's address. And by being seen as equally worthy, the poet, by addressing both president and slave, makes both parties into common objects of love, of admiration, of affection, of respect. The poet in this way stands for what is common, for what doesn't need to be argued, for what doesn't need to be justified. The poet stands for what is fundamentally shared, what is there for everyone to see, for everyone to know. Both understand him and know that his speech is right. This question of connection, of joining, what is it then that is between us? Whitman will ask incessantly throughout his life. His search for words that will answer this question will push him right to the limits of language itself. And so, what he calls what it is that is between us, at one point, he describes it as a religious element, a breath of life that breathes through the proud material tissues of dignified humans, the breath of life. By bringing together the image of the creation of the human from the soil in Genesis 2 and the events of Pentecost, by bringing together these with St. Paul's image of the many members animated by the one divine spirit so as to make up the body of Christ, Whitman elevates the task of tending, of cultivating, of attending to the spaces between us to a kind of divine vocation. Because it's in these conditions of mutual encounter, it's by tending to the spaces between us that we open up the possibility of moral encounter, of mutual transformation. We don't just have to look, though, to Whitman's great poem. There's a novel that I've come to adore over the course of the last few years by the British novelist Ali Smith. In the second of her Seasons Quartet, the novel entitled Winter, there is a remarkable moment where four people gather together on a winter's evening. From memory, it's either Christmas Eve or it's Christmas Day. I believe it's Christmas Eve. These four people gather together in the British countryside at a table in a rural, rustic farmhouse. The four people are experiencing various degrees of fractions, of breaks, of alienation among them. Two of them in particular, the two sisters, Iris and Sophia, haven't spoken to one another in years. Iris represents, if you like, revolutionary Britain. Both of them are very elderly, but Iris was a peace activist and anti-nuclear campaigner. In the novel, Iris represents, if you like, the Leave case. This is a great Brexit novel. Iris represents the Remain in the EU, Remain with the common British community. Sophia represents a form of nostalgic nationalism. She's made a fortune by turning new furniture into furniture that looks like it's older than it really is, appealing to those who want to deck their house out in sort of fake classical or fake antique furniture. And then there are another two. Lux, a young woman who has been dragged there under false pretenses by Sophia's son, Art. And then there is Art himself. The three of them are gathered around a table for what is surely one of the most uncomfortable gatherings ever recorded in fiction. At one point, however, due to Lux, this girl's insistence that the truth always be told, her resistance to lies, to cover-ups, to prevarications of any form, due to Lux's careful insistence, this patient insistence on the truth, there's a moment between the two sisters, the two alienated sisters, Iris and Sophia, one standing for New Britain, for future Britain, the other standing for Old Britain, for nostalgic Britain. There is a moment where something that's a little bit too true comes out into the open. Lux, remember, is the word for light. That's her role, to cause everyone to see themselves truly, to see one another truly. At this moment where a little bit too much truth is told, silence descends upon the table. Everyone simply lingers. And at that moment, Art has a vision of the four of them around this table, underneath the rich brown-green soil, in fertile territory where new life can spring, can sprout. At that moment, Art realizes that the air between them is rich, is conducive for moral encounter. And it's this vision, then, that paves the way for one of the tenderest moments of reconciliation, when later that evening, Sophia, who's very weak, who's very frail, who's very sick, is lying shivering in her bed, and her sister, her also elderly sister, comes up, as she did when they were both young, climbs into bed with her, and cuddles her to keep her warm. Two warring parties, due to the conditions between them coming fertile from moral encounter, finding cause for reconciliation, for mutual transformation. beautiful, beautiful moment. The task of tending to the spaces between us, ultimately, is the task of attentiveness. If we are to gather together the threads that I've been pulling out, I think we can begin seeing a number of characteristics, the elements that make up the practice of attentiveness. To be attentive, first and foremost, is to cultivate the space between us, to allow there to be an interval, a gap, a hesitation, a space that is rich and fertile, that's full of grace. This, I think, recognizing this aspect of attentiveness, the knowing when to be silent, the knowing when to speak, the knowing when to be gentle, the knowing when to confront. This is a reminder, I think, of the temptation that the fat, relentless ego, this is Iris Murdoch's description of the debauched, disformed, malformed moral life. This is a reminder that the fat, relentless ego is always prepared, is always ready, is always willing to rush in and to fill that space between persons, those uncomfortable moments, with itself, with its own agenda. This reminds us that what attentiveness always needs is time, is patience. We also see, I think, that the practice of attentiveness is not hazy. It's not that we look at one another with rose-colored glasses. It's not that we paper over the real differences between us. Instead, attentiveness is characterized by love and by justice. This is the novelist and philosopher Iris Murdoch's great point, that when we see one another attentively, when we pay attention to the moral reality of another person, we are seeing them as they are. We are seeing them truly. We are seeing them with the eyes of both love and justice. And that's why Murdoch will say towards the end of her life, a loving and just gaze cherishes. A contemptuous gaze withers. This is to say then that attentiveness, looking at one another attentively, cultivating the space between us, allows for flaws and faults. It's not that we don't see what's true about the other person, but it's that we don't allow those faults and those flaws to represent the end of the relationship. To see someone attentively, to see them justly and lovingly, is to cultivate the conditions within which that relationship can continue, can go on. One of the many ways I think we've corrupted the whole language of morality in our time is that we see morality as a way of forming judgment on another person. To be moral, to enact a form of moral judgment, is to condemn, is to exile, is to push someone out of human community. Whereas, in fact, moral judgment is a matter of cultivating the conditions between us, creating the possibility, the openings, the connections within which, despite our faults, despite our flaws, despite our obtuseness, our vanity, our selfishness, our egotism, despite all those things, the relationship can go on. New pathways, new forms of communication, of attentiveness, of forgiveness, of reconciliation can be discovered. This is also why we can say that attentiveness has no agenda. Attentiveness has no goal, no end, apart from a goal or an end that is discovered through the process of mutual transformation. That's to say, and I think this may well be the most important thing that I have to say to you, nothing is lost by being attentive to another person. Nothing is lost by seeing another person justly, lovingly, tenderly. Nothing is lost by discovering, by patiently waiting to find the moral reality of another person. Nothing is lost through patient attendance. Nothing is lost through silence. Nothing is lost through hesitancy before the moral ground of another person. Finally, beautifully, attentiveness to another person allows that person to be seen as a worthy object of love by others. The person who's being attentive isn't a saint. The point of saintliness isn't to draw attention to itself. The point of attentiveness is to draw attention entirely to the other person so that that person may be seen as an object worthy of love. You can see then how something like satire or hate speech, contemptuous op-eds, withering tweets, blasphemous Facebook posts, all of these things cause people to see the object of that satire, the object of that hate speech, the object of that badly worded, inattentive, overly outraged op-ed as an object of derision, of contempt, as someone who doesn't deserve a hearing, someone who need not be taken seriously. Attentiveness permits another person to be seen rightly as a worthy object of love. We can draw all these things together, I think, what attentiveness does by contrasting attentiveness with contempt. As the great novelist Marilynne Robinson put it, contempt imposes, asserts itself. Grace discovers. Contempt generalizes, paints everybody with the same brush. You're just that kind of person. Grace is charmed by haunting particularities. Contempt entraps. Grace frees. If attentiveness is then the opposite of contempt, what does contempt do? Firstly, contempt, especially forms of contempt that take on the shape of a kind of moral veneer, that take on the shape of moral seriousness or moral judgment. Contempt generalizes. You are all that kind of person. You belong to that kind of camp. I know what it is that you think. I know what it is that you want. You have nothing to say that I need to hear. I need not attend to you. You are just that kind of person. Generalization permits no moment of hesitation, no waiting to discover the depth, the reality, the moral intention, the moral intensity of the other person. By sacrificing the complexity of another person, contempt grandstands. It flaunts itself in a position of moral superiority over another. So first, contempt generalizes. You're all that kind of person. Second, contempt grandstands. It uses the language of morality as a form of moral superiority. It uses other people as footstools, as objects of ridicule, by means of which they can promote themselves. They can see themselves and cause other people to see them in a better light. Ultimately, grandstanding is another word for moral vanity. Grandstanding wishes that the other person, one's enemies, didn't exist. Or if they do want them to exist, they want them to exist as causes of fun, as objects of satire, as objects of ridicule, footstools on which I can stand and flaunt, vaunt, promote myself. Contempt pushes down. Attentiveness frees. Finally, contempt is an expression of egotism. Contempt is the product of what Iris Murdoch calls the fat, relentless ego, the great planet that exists at the center of a vain, self-centered solar system. Everything else revolves around the reality of that ego. Everyone else is divided up into either friends or enemies. Seems to me the finest, the best example of this is from Shakespeare's play, King Lear. Lear, who's blinded already by his own insecurity and vanity, demands performances of love and flattery from his craven, cruel eldest daughters, Goneril and Regan. And yet, This same pathetic human, all too human Lear is terrified by the genuine devotion of his youngest daughter, Cordelia. Lear richly rewards flatterers with what remains of his majesty, and he banishes his enemies, anybody who will stand up to him. After condemning his truest, most virtuous youngest daughter, Cordelia, to exile, Lear's loyal servant and subject, the Earl of Kent, tries to open his eyes. Kent says that Lear is blinded by fear of irrelevance and mortality, that he doesn't see the world, the people around him clearly, that he's just pawning off what remains of his majesty in exchange for hollow, disingenuous expressions of flattery and devotion from those who will swiftly betray him. This is what Kent says. "Answer my life, my judgment, thy youngest daughter does not love thee least, nor are those empty-hearted whose low sounds reverb no hollowness." Lear says, "Kent, on thy life," in other words, on the threat of thy life, "no more." Kent responds, "My life I never held but as a pawn to wage against thine enemies, ne'er fill to lose it, thy safety being my motive." In other words, "My life has only ever been in your service, Lear. I'm not afraid to lose it now." Lear says to loyal Kent, "Out of my sight." Kent pleads with Lear in words that, it seems to me, appeal also to us in our vanity, in our egotism, in our fear, in our contempt, in our worry that what we have is going to be taken away from us, in our worry that our enemies might triumph over us, in our worry that what matters most in the world is disappearing, in our fear that those that we disdain most may well triumph, in our worry that we might be disappearing, in our concern to hold on to what we can while we can. These words now speak to us. Lear says to the loyal Kent, "Out of my sight." And Kent responds, "See better, Lear, and let me remain."
You've been listening to the 2021 Richard Johnson Lecture delivered by Scott Stevens. Now, Scott Stevens is the ABC's Religion and Ethics online editor and co-host with Waleed Ali of The Minefield on ABC Radio National. His book, On Contempt, is published by Melbourne University Press. Please check out our other podcast, Life and Faith, which is a weekly conversation about the beauty and complexity of belief in the 21st century. And you can find that wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to know more about CPX, our website is publicchristianity.org.